Thank you. Thank you so much. I'm so pleased to be asked to talk about this topic because it's much more in my wheelhouse. I feel much more comfortable with it. I spent the last 18 months finishing up a book on on the predecessors to Carl Schmitt in the right Hegelian tradition. That was so terrible. I hated every minute of it. So forget it. We're done. Although this subject's going to come up tonight, as you know. Right, because we're going to be talking about nationalism, so maybe I'll have something to say about it after all. My new book is called The Market Loves You, Why You Should Love It Back. So I'm excited about it. I got to talk to you for about 30 minutes so we can do some Q&A, or we can start with Q&A. Let me ask myself a question. Don't you think it's terrible the way government is gathering data on us? Yes, it's terrible. I don't like when government gathers data on us. They've been doing it since the ancient world. As far as I know, that's why Mary and Joseph were dragged off to Bethlehem, you know, to be counted. It's awful. Governments have been doing this. We want them out of the data collection business. We should get them out of the planning business. And that's I think, the answer. It's not about a problem of technology. It's a problem of the government. Okay, so that's a big question. Another one is, does it annoy you that the mainstream social media is gathering data on you, knows your whereabouts and everything? Yes, it annoys me, and I'm very glad to tell you that Facebook is losing market share. I'm really happy about that. In fact, Zuckerberg just a couple of weeks ago announced a change in this business model from collecting and selling your data to granting you privacy. And you know, we are all just so trusting of Mark Zuckerberg at this point. You know, wow, he's got our best interests at heart. Okay, another question. My son can't stop gaming. You know, he's always gaming all the time. Well, I don't know what to tell you. Young men suck until they're like 30 years old. So, you know, you just have to deal with it. I don't know what to tell you. Another is, my daughter just can't stay off the iPhone. Take it away. That's my answer to that, you know. Actually, the funny thing about young people and digital tools is that they're actually better at using them than older people. Have you noticed this? Like, they're less interested in this constant obsessive pulling at your phone all the time. It's like older people, you go to dinner with them and you say, wow, it's cold outside. And they go, oh, hey, Siri, what's the weather in Chicago? All right, you spill a little ketchup on you. Hey, Siri, how do you get ketchup out of a white shirt? You know, it's tremendously annoying. I think it's just because for older people, among whom I include myself, this was just such an exciting thing to have this technology, and we just fell in love with it. But young people who were raised with it are ever more sort of bored with it, actually, and less obsessed with it. I think we could all be less obsessed with technology, actually. I work at the American Institute for Economic Research, and we have a rule in the House that in any public space, I mean, this is a very large house. In any public space where there's people present, use of cell phones is banned. When I first got there, I thought, this is never going to work for me. But I got used to it, and now I like it. And I'm less attached to my technology than I ever have been, actually. So, you know, it's a matter of, like, adapting to the new technology and figuring out a new etiquette that's associated with it. The relationship between technology and our behavior and etiquette and the court of taste and manners, as Albert Jaynock used to call it, is complicated. You know, first we get the cool new tool, then we all abuse it, we make jerks out of ourselves, it ruins our lives, and then we gradually discover new rules on how to use it. You remember when cell phones first came along? It was a big deal, right? That, like, when I was growing up, You had one phone in the house and it was attached to the wire and the government owned it. And that was the way life worked. And I dreamed of someday having a phone that would be all mine and I would carry it in my pocket. And I would take paper clips and open it up with a little antenna and pretend I had a secret friend I would talk to, you know. Well, this eventually became true, but then we became very annoying about it. We go to the restaurants and, yeah, well, yeah, sure. How's my stocks doing? Yes, going up? Stock's going up, huh? Well, good. Always great to make money. That's what I'm doing right here. It was terrible. But I haven't seen anybody doing that in a very long time, right? like we've fixed ourselves. We adapted. We learned how to use technology in a better way. And we're always going to be learning how to do this. So that's the theme of my remarks here today, is that we shouldn't panic. We should look on the bright side, anticipate. Yes, there's plenty of failings and plenty of problems, but we can anticipate the natural processes of cultural adaption and social evolution to gradually civilize them. And I think we're desperately in the need right now of civilizing the technologies that have washed over us in the last 20 years to the point that we're just a little, many, many people are panicked and worried about it, and they feel like they've their lives have been invaded. There's many things you can do to actually fix that in your own life, and we'll talk about them a little bit. But first, I want to pass on to you something that really touched me deeply the other day. And I'm finding ever more ways to apply it. It's a parable by Kierkegaard. You know he wrote parables, right? And so many, hundreds of them, and they're all so beautiful. And this is the parable of the two artists. So, as he tells the story, the first artist is highly competent and brilliant and well-traveled and highly regarded. And his personal ambition in life was to find the most beautiful face and paint thereby the most beautiful portrait ever. But he was met with frustration because every face he looked at, he found flaws and found that there was no face ultimately worthy of being painted, and gave up his craft and died in despair. The second artist was less well-traveled, less well-competent, less well-trained, but had a delightful outlook on life. And in his small friend circle, every face he looked at, he found something beautiful and painted that face. He saw the beauty and tried to relay that beauty within the painting. And Kierkegaard asked the question, who is the better painter? Yeah? I think we know. It's a beautiful parable. I think we can learn from this, because many of us are in the position as intellectuals of being this artist. We can find the beauty in the world as it is, or we can constantly look down on it and find imperfections, condemn it, and want to go away completely, secede from it, sit around bemoaning the fact that we're not living in 1250, you know, as or in the interwar period, you know, as some people these days are doing. Or somebody like all the ideological trends of our time are strangely revanchist and reactionary, you know, and this goes for both the right and the left. I mean, like AOC with her, I don't know, longing to live in some sort of primitive conditions, you know, in which we don't drive or fly or eat meat. And I was reading an interview the other day with a couple of journalists who went to Venezuela, and they said, "Oh, really?" I mean, this is in the left-wing rag called Counterpunch or something like that. And they said, "Really, it's a lovely country. It's everything's going so well there. People are misrepresenting it, you know." And the journalist said, "Yeah, but what about the blackouts?" They said, "Oh, let me tell you, blackouts were great. The kids were playing out in the street, you know, getting to know their neighbors, you know, dominoes in the evening, and people got off their cell phones, you know." And the journalist said, "Well, okay, but, I mean, aren't there problems getting food?" And the journalist said, "Listen, I'm telling you, it's wonderful. There's no meat at all. Everybody's had to become a vegetarian." True interview. So, I mean, I would say about this is the nature of a person who looks at the world and only sees corruption, horror, and dreadful things and wants to blow it up, the Green New Deal style thing. This is artist number one, essentially. You know, a person who can't find beauty in the real world at all is forever trying to emanatize the eschaton to create some perfect thing that can't ever happen. And that person ultimately will despair and give up. The second artist I think of as being people who appreciate the market, appreciate the processes of society, understand that imperfections will always be with us, and that the best we can do in this world is develop adaptive social systems that can ferret out the problems and gradually fix them, but ultimately find the beauty all around us and celebrate it. And I hope that we can be that second kind of artist. In a funny way, the market itself is that artist, always finding the beautiful things around us and presenting it to us. I think that's what's happened over the last 20 years. You know, you have to ask yourself, why did the information age come along? Why did we enter into this digital age? It's because we didn't like the way we lived before, and we wanted to find a better way to live with each other. To develop human connection with each other is really something very deep within us. We have this desire to form communities, to find people who value us and return that value in exchange, to develop networks of connection to make our lives better. That's everything that's happened over the last 20 years. That's what it's been all about. And it has dramatically changed our lives. Do any of you ever watch, I have this obsession with film noir from the 40s. Do you ever watch film noir films from the 40s, crime shows and things? Almost every plot in those movies turns on mistaken identity and people hiding. Like they commit some crime or they're being ferreted out by somebody, so they're in trouble or something, and they think, well, what should I do? What should we do, honey? Well, let's drive across state lines. Nobody will ever find us that way. What? It's unthinkable. Unthinkable now. It's like, well, let's just, and then they go across the border and, put on a big nose and glasses or something like that. And they're sitting in their hotel room and safe and fine, and suddenly the phone rings and they're staring at it. Why is that phone ringing? So they answer it, disguise their voice, and get away a little bit. So it takes 2 hours, but eventually they found out, right? This is an inconceivable thing to us. Like, none of these plots would work at all in our time. But that's because we want connection, we want familiarity, we want to talk to people that are not geographically contiguous to us. We want to discover other human beings and find interest and share information with them so that we can live a better life. I mean, in my own work life, I've seen so many dramatic changes. I've not always been this techno-utopian guy. Like, I was actually a grave skeptic when email first came along. Because I thought, basically, the end of history was the modem that you could call up and transfer data over it. I thought, there's no other technology we're ever going to need in the whole history of humanity. So when my friend Tom Bethel called me up, he said, Jeffrey, have you heard of this thing called email? I said, no. He said, well, we should consider it. And I said, well, what does it do? He says, well, you, for example, dial up on your modem, and then you send a message to somebody, but he or she doesn't have to be there to receive it. It's sent to some kind of box. So that way you don't have to coordinate. You don't have to call a person and say, get on your modem, and then we can say, just at their leisure, he or she can log in and get the message from you. I said, well, where does it go? Yeah, I don't know about that. I said, okay. So, here's the problem. How do they know there's a message there? He said, huh. Probably just give them a call. I said, well, see, that's what I'm saying. This is all utterly useless. He goes, well, good point, and he hung up the phone. So you can't always anticipate the uses of things, really. But it took only a few years when I discovered actually the most remarkable thing for me. I was working in the ideas industry and wanted to connect with people, but back in the day, the only way you could really get your ideas out there is if you were in a position of privilege. You had a connection with a publisher, So you had a connection with an editor. You could get into print. Were you going to get your message out? There wasn't really any way. And then along came, it was a proprietary software at the time, this thing called the listserv. Because we did develop email, and it was very nice. And we were doing emailing people, and, oh, you got an email address, that's great, you know, give me your email address. But when the listserv came along, that meant that multiple people could join the same list. You send one message to one address, and it would be distributed among everybody else. And I tell you, that for me personally, that was the opening of the world. Because everybody involved in my community of thought could suddenly talk to each other, and it was wild. It was crazy. We didn't even know what to do. Writing, you know, was so rarefied a thing that when we would send messages to each other on the listserv, we didn't know how to account. Can you cite them? I mean, should this be considered like canonical? Is this really what you're thinking? You know, do we footnote this when we write our academic articles? How do we? And so there's a discussion among us. How should we treat this? They said, well, we should treat it like, just like cocktail conversation. These things we say, you know, over drinks. You know, something to learn from, but not necessarily to consider canonical. And I thought, well, that's reasonable. But of course, the listserv became the basis for everything that happened after that, ultimately deprecated and replaced. And now we have, you know, infinite ways we can access each other. But it's that formation of human community driven by, made accessible by the market to the rest of us. And I think it's very lovely and very beautiful and worth celebrating. The old 19th century term for technology, I don't even like the term technology, actually. I think it's terrible. It's like scientistic in a Hayekian way. It's just too cold and strange. In the 19th century, and this takes us back to Kierkegaard's parable, technology was called the practical arts. I like that. It's an art, except it's very practical. It helps us live a better life. The world's fairs in the late 19th century loved technology. Everything was good. The masses would show up to see all the newest things, from Ferris wheels to telephones, to hamburgers, you know, which were released in, I think, Chicago World's Fair sometime in the 1880s. Very beautiful concept. And of course, we got really cynical about technology after World War I when we saw that life wasn't just going to be perfect the more we improve it, that these things can be abused. And we've gotten cynical over time. And I think in a strange way, we're living through right now a real backlash against technology. And I think it's getting really scary, actually. We all live now in the wake of what happened in New Zealand, right? A few weeks ago. This guy grows up with the internet, being involved in very dark, scary corners of the internet, being indoctrinated by quasi-Nazi murderous ideology, gets consumed with hatred, accesses guns, and goes out and slaughters people. And it's terrifying to us. I think it was a kind of a shock, or maybe it was the culmination of a shock that we've been getting over time, that not everything in the digital world is or can be perfect. And what are we discovering? I think what we're discovering is the dark part of the human heart, you know? I think the techno-utopianism that gave birth to platforms like Facebook and Twitter and a couple other dozen of these beautiful things has gradually changed, so that we're realizing that our technology is going to be actually the way we use technology is going to be a true reflection of who we are, which is not all good and not all bad, but a real mixture between the two. And our technologies are getting better at discovering this. I remember in the early days when the first internet forums came along, and I was the moderator over a forum on economics that had something like, it was anybody could join, and we had something like 600 members. And it just began to consume me entirely on dealing with the problem of trolls. You know, the trolls are the people that just want to disrupt the space, get attention for themselves, typically anonymous, make life miserable for everyone else. I gradually, over time, began to develop a rule in my own mind that trolls constitute 3% of the human population. I don't know if that's high or low or whatever. It's never been tested, but that's... And we have to get better at excluding them. So, like, I think we had a questioner earlier in the day concerned about censorship and so on Facebook, and I don't want to belittle that, and I'm sure there's an ideological component to it, but can you imagine the challenge of running a basic internet forum for 1 billion people, 2 billion people? It's inconceivable. In fact, I think it's unmanageable. It cannot happen, which I think these centralized platforms are ultimately going to die because they're not meeting people's needs. All right, so that's where we've been. And that's, you know, I would say that, I don't know, how many of you ever watched the show Jetsons? I wrote a book called The Jetsons World. I love that. It's, you know, that show is strangely brilliant because it posited a world in which the human family, the normal family of the 1950s still was the same kind of family in some uncertain time in the 21st century. The only difference, so the daughter is still a daughter, the son's still a son, is still skipping out of school, getting in trouble with the teacher, the father's kind of a burned out, slightly lazy bum, but an earnest fellow, and the wife's always trying to work on their marriage, and so on. It's like they're renovating their house all the time. I mean, they're just normal people. Human nature has not changed in the Jetsons world. They're just us. The only difference is they have cooler things. You know, they just have different kinds of tools. And that's who we are today. We're no different than we were before the digital age began. We're the exact same people. We just have nicer, neater, funner tools that have made us ultimately more connected to each other and more productive. But it doesn't affect us in any other way. So here's the question. Why is it that we should actually care about living in an information age? I think probably there's some of you here that are thinking, you know, it was better before all this nonsense came along. Looking back with some sense of nostalgia. Let me offer for you a paradigm that's helped me think through this really, really, that I'm consumed with, actually, entirely. And I get it from F.A. Hayek. F.A. Hayek said that the world can be split into two kind of categories of goods, that which is scarce and that which is not scarce. Scarce goods have to be allocated, and we need to find a peaceful way to do that. His suggestion is that we establish private property rights and incentivize people to exchange and create wealth and allocate scarce goods based on price that gradually emerges out of human choice. That's the best way to deal with the problem of scarcity, so that we have to kill each other to get a bite to eat. Scarcity gives rise to conflicts. Conflicts are solved through markets. On the other hand, he said, there's the realm of the non-scarce. And the realm of the non-scarce consists of primarily the ideas that we hold in our heads, that we share with each other. Infinitely reproducible, so that you can take any idea that I've had here today, out the door with you, and share it with your friends. It's not going to take it from me. It's not a scarce good. I'm not going to wake up tomorrow morning being unable to remember Kierkegaard's parable because you remembered it, right? It's infinitely reproducible, and it's infinitely malleable. And therefore, it does not need to be allocated by ownership or prices or being governed by a structure of production or any other economic considerations. And Hayek, the economist, says in Constitution of Liberty that between the two, the realm of non-scarcity is far more valuable to the world. So the body of ideas that we carry around with in our heads, that has been ported through civilization over the centuries, over several millennia, is far more valuable than all the capital stock in the world. Because to have the know-how, to have the information on serving each other and living a better life is the very basis for material prosperity, spiritual fulfillment, and everything else. So it's the realm of non-scarcity that's the most important thing. The beauty of the internet and the digital age is that it has ported vast amounts of the things that used to be scarcified through the physical world into a digital world that where these same things become infinitely malleable and reproducible. In that sense, the digital age has made us thrive so much more as human beings, and it's made us vastly more prosperous than we should have been. I mean, what's taken we would otherwise have been? My own feeling about this is that, you know, over the last 20 years, the revolution that's taken place in technology should have been far more benevolent and beneficent to humanity. We should have been experiencing double-digit rates of economic growth. We should be far more wealthy than we would have been. We are, if we had the same kind of regime that we had in the late 19th century, or in the 18th century, the Industrial Revolution, or the late 19th century with all the explosion of technology that took place then, where the governments were small and stayed out. Over the last 20 years, governments have become ever more aggressive in regulatory and taxing and, you know, protectionism and all the horrors associated with big government. They've kind of robbed us of the prosperity we otherwise would have experienced in the digital age. And I think that is a terrible, terrible tragedy. All right. Last night, we talked a little bit about Bitcoin, and I want to bring this up here to you today because I know there's a lot of curiosity about it. But here's the thing. Of all the products that the digital age has granted us, the single most exciting thing to me is blockchain technology and the possibility of completely privatizing money assets and separating them from the state. In so many ways, the nationalization of money that happened in the late 19th century in Europe and in the early part of the 20th century in America was the beginning of the end. I mean, there never would have been World War I without central banks. We wouldn't have experienced the Great Depression. The Bolshevik Revolution never would have happened were it not for the unity of money in the state and the Russian government. It led to inflation, it led to a lot of anger and disability. Hitler would have never come to power without the inflation in Germany in the 1922 and 1923. I mean, the horrors that have occurred, the gutting of the American capital stock in the 1970s as a result of mismanagement of centralized money, the horrors and carnage that have been caused by the unity of money in the state in the course of the 20th century is impossible to overstate. Hayek in 1974, after fighting for a lifetime for sound money, finally said, you know what? We can't get reformed from the top. We've got to find another way to reform the system. And that the only way to reform it is for there to be an innovation, where you have fully private money that exists outside the state. Probably it'll come about as a result of the banking system, but whatever, however it happens, it's got to happen. But nobody knew how it could happen. All throughout the early 2000s, people tried and tried and tried. I saw all kinds of things come and go. They all broke. I became a real skeptic. That this could ever happen, and then 2008, the great white paper of Satoshi Nakamoto came out. I read it the first time. I didn't understand a word of it because I didn't understand hashing technology and cryptography and distributed networks and all the rest of these things. But it took me a couple of years. I remember getting an email in 2000, I guess it was like September 2010 from a guy who said, you know, Tucker, you love the idea of sound money and separating money from the state. You really need to be looking at Bitcoin. And I dug up the email the other day and looked at it again. I just replied to somebody like, thank you very much. This is what you say when you dismiss somebody on email, right? Go away, who cares? So it took me a couple of years. But when I first experienced that, my first experience of genuine private money, digital money, was a glorious thing. and I studied hard, and I tried to understand it, what could it do? I think ultimately it is the future of the money, because not just Bitcoin itself, actually, I think BTC as a technology has completely flopped. It's been actually just a disaster for very strange reasons. But the idea behind it can result in something, I think, fabulous, and ultimately replace central banks, nationalized money, simply because it's a much, much better technology. It allows peer-to-peer, unmediated exchange between you and anybody else in the world through this beautiful technology called the blockchain, which is nothing other than a very highly sophisticated way of keeping track of ownership rights, which is something civilization has to do. We've been doing it since ancient Mesopotamia, and it's been going. That's what printing was about. That's what incentivized printing. That's what vellum was about. That's in the Middle Ages. That's what gave birth to the Medicis. That's what databases in the 1970s were about. And this is the next iteration. If we can keep track of our property rights, what I own and what you own, we can have a more peaceful society. And if we can port this beautiful system of tracking ownership rights into the creation and use of a fully private globalized money, I don't think that there's much hope for the nation state at that point. I think it's going to die, actually, as we know it. The nation state as we know it is going to die under the pressure of cryptocurrency. And I hope it does. All right, I've almost used up all my time and I want to open it for questions, but let me just end up this way. Mentioned the Kierkegaard parable. Now, I think many of us in this room think of ourselves as conservatives, possibly as libertarians, but we're attached to eternal verities. We're attached to the permanent things, as T.S. Eliot said. I think there's a tendency for this to make us all maybe a little cautious, reticent, skeptical, or maybe oppositional in our view towards technology. I don't think that it needs to be this way. We can love the old values. We can love the old norms. We can have an appreciation for the cultural inheritance of the West, our robust religious traditions, manners, taste, etiquette, all the things that are wonderful, and still love technology too and celebrate it. I think it's extremely important that in our own minds we think it this way. To be a traditionalist does not necessarily mean to throw out your cell phone. It's not necessary. To be a conservative doesn't mean to decry the growing sophistication of trade and technology that is ultimately serving humanity. We can maintain both these stances. This is not some kind of strange Meyer-style fusionism I'm advocating. I'm just saying that these are really two different realms. Technology is not wrecking our culture. It's up to us to save our culture, and we can use technology to do it. We can be the Jetsons, basically, is what I'm saying. Old-fashioned family, new tools. We just got to get better at it. Some suggestions I would use for this. Something I've learned from being in Great Barrington at American Institute for Economic Research. We live in a century-old castle, so I'm surrounded by the old world, and it's just wonderful. I've developed a real appreciation for the beauty of the old world and the capacity of us to recreate that in our own lives, a more humane life, small things. In almost every room in that house, there is a mechanical clock. And I tell you what, you can get one at any antique store in the town you live, but there's something so... Wait, you're not going to believe this. It doesn't plug in. It took me a while to realize this. I was like, wait, where's the cord? The mechanical tick on that thing is so lovely. So beautiful, it cannot be created with any digital technology. And the fact that you have to wind it every day kind of gives you something to fiddle with. You're like human hands winding this beautiful clock. It's like this living homage to this, the glory of the past, especially the American clocks, which were one of the largest industries in this country. We had the biggest clock industry in the world. Where was this place? It was in Connecticut. 30,000 employees worked in the clock industry in the late 19th century. Clocks were essential because people were moving to the cities and they had to keep time for the first time. They had to show up and work on time. And wow, what a luxury it was that there would be a clock in every house. Unimaginable prosperity. So beautiful. Anyway, there's a beautiful story behind the mechanical clocks, but you know what? It's a lovely thing to have one in your house. You go to bed at night and you think, well, I'm never going to go to sleep with that crazy loud ticking and gong. There's just something about it that's just, you know, humane and beautiful. Another thing that we've done around the house is we've replaced every one of those evil LED bright white light bulbs that are so tyrannically horrible and oppressive and replaced them with beautiful, lovely Edison bulbs. You know? You know what I'm talking about? These Edison bulbs, they seem like it appeals to our primal need to sit by the fire, really. Things like this. You know, and of course, one of the beautiful things, too, about technology is that it's allowed us to experience the old world in a way in which it was inconceivable in the past. So I can say, you know, hey, Google, play me Salieri. Hey, Google, play Mozart. Play Haydn. You know, play me some Gregorian chant. And the room fills up with this lovely music. I mean, it's a wonderful, to me, it's just magical to see the way technology can integrate the best of the old and the best of the new. What I would urge you, though, in closing, is to be that second artist, to find the beauty around us, incorporate it into your life. It's huge solutions to these problems that involve coercion and asking government to do things for us. Smash Google, smash Facebook. It's not going to work. The best way we're going to tame, civilize technology and help it become a tool for the creation of a free society is to take control of it ourselves. Make adaptions in our own lives. Like as I say, be that second artist. Thank you very much.